Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
Almost nobody gets through this life without some heartbreak. It's a bizarre feature of human existence that even after the object of our affection makes it abundantly clear they're done, we want them back anyway. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We cry, we wallow and obsess, we lose sleep and slip up at work, all because we are convinced we'll never again find anybody so great. The good news is there's a right way to mend a broken heart. The bad news is most of us have been doing it wrong. As a psychologist in private practice, Guy Winch has helped countless clients learn the skills for living through the end of an affair. He's distilled his best advice into a new book called How to Fix a Broken Heart, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Guy, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
You focus in this book on romantic breakups between unmarried folks and grief over pets who have died. In both cases, society is less concerned with our mental states than if, say, we had a formal divorce or we lost a human loved one, but the pain can be almost equivalent.
That's right, and that's why I chose those two topics, because the grief response that we have, or we can have in those situations, can rival that of losing a first-degree relative even. And yet, it's not something that's sanctioned. No one is going into work saying, I need a couple of days off because my cat died. And so not only we don't know how to heal, we don't accept that this is something that's actually worthy of significant attention.
And then we wonder if there's something wrong with us when we don't instantly bounce back.
We wonder if there's something wrong with us that we don't bounce back, and we wonder why we're acting so out of sorts and why we are not ourselves and what's wrong with us. Are we losing our mind that we feel so bereft and we're acting so crazy sometimes, and we don't realize that actually there are very good reasons for the way we're acting and feeling.
What's happening in our brains in a heartbreak situation?
So there are two kinds of brain studies which I found fascinating in researching this book. One of them was that when they looked at what happens to compare what social emotional pain looks like, heartbreak looks like in the brain, to compare it to physical pain, they asked for volunteers who had a recent heartbreak and put them in functional brain scanners, MRI machines, where they stuck the picture of the person who broke their heart to the top of the tube and had them look at the picture and relive the breakup. And then they looked at what was happening in their brain. And in the second part of that, they attached heat inducers to the people's forearms that they could raise the heat from a level of 1, which was mild discomfort, theoretically to 10, which was unbearable pain. And it's when they reached level 8, like near unbearable pain, that the brain started to look very similar to what it looks like when people were heartbroken. So their conclusion was that the pathways for emotional pain and heartbreak in that sense piggyback on the pathways for physical pain. We literally hurt. And in the second study that I found, series of studies rather, they looked at what happens in our brain, again, when we're heartbroken. And what they saw was that the same mechanisms are getting activated as they saw getting activated when heroin addicts were withdrawing from opioids. And that went a long way toward explaining the absolute desperateness that we feel, the craving that we feel when we're heartbroken, that the person who broke our heart is that getting them back, having contact with them is the only thing that matters and nothing else does. And it accounts for all the really out of character behavior you see around heartbreak.
Well, here's what I don't get, Guy. So if I have felt that, you know, the painful stimuli on my forearm and it gets to level 8 and that level of discomfort is what I feel when I look at a picture of, you know, my ex-person, in the kitchen, I'm going to know not to touch that hot thing again. But boy, when someone has broken up with us, we want to look at pictures, right? And we want to think about them and we want to plot all the ways that we can get them back. Why don't we realize that we're going to literally get burned again?
We do realize that. In the same way that heroin addicts know that when they're doing all kinds of things like prostituting themselves and putting themselves at risk and breaking the law to get a fix, they're not deluding themselves into thinking that they're doing fine things. Mm-hmm. They're just that desperate. And that's the analogy. It's not that we don't know that it's probably not a good idea. It's not that we don't know that, yeah, there were difficult moments in the relationship. But at that moment, the only thing we're convinced matters is getting that person back. And like a heroin addict, the fact that it's really bad for us or will damage us or not end well doesn't stop us because the desperation is that severe.
So we should definitely avoid that sort of contact. And that can mean cutting the person out of our social media routine, which is hard for people because now even if you don't call the person, you can sort of keep up with what they're up to online.
So here's the tricky part of it, and this is how I usually try and explain it to people. What does getting over somebody really mean? Well, what it really means is that you think about them less and less as time goes on, and that when you do, it evokes less pain, less of an ache, as time goes on. So the goal, therefore, in recovery from heartbreak is to diminish the presence of that person in your mind, to get them to appear less in your thoughts, less in your dreams, less in your fantasies, less in your waking hours. And then you have to ask yourself, okay, so the action I'm about to take, is that going to actually decrease the presence of the person in my mind or reinforce it and increase it? And so scouring all the social media is actually going to make you think about the person more. It's going to make you miss them more. It's going to make everything hurt more. And your goal is to make them recede from a starring role in your mind to an extra at best, if not a walk-on, or if not getting axed from the show.
Why are we so prone to ruminating on the end of a relationship in search of a reason why the other person didn't want us?
Well, this is what typically happens, and it's a real setup for this, and we have to understand it. The person has been thinking about breaking up for a while. They haven't voiced it, and if they have voiced it, they've been thinking about it even before they did. So they have a massive head start on getting used to the idea that we're going to break up. And they have been processing it and moving away emotionally and drifting and getting over you, as it were, for a while. When they tell you about it is when they're absolutely certain, but then they've already disconnected in a way. However, they've been faking it, probably, till they did tell us. No one wants to say to their, you know, partner, I'm having some thoughts or doubts about you. Just thought I'd let you know, because that's not a productive conversation
right.
to have. So when they tell you, they're certain, and they're already past it. What you think, what you see, though, is, wow, last week they said I love you, and this weekend we had a fine time. We might even have been on this great vacation a month ago. What happened between that vacation and now, or last week? And something must have happened because they seemed so present and now they're so distant. Something massive must have happened. Now, nothing happened. It's just when they decided to come clean and stop faking. And so, but it sets up for you a real mystery, a real sleuthing task of figuring out what that dramatic thing was, that from the time they said I love you last Friday till when they broke up on Sunday, what happened? But since it's nothing, it'll just send you down rabbit's hole of, and then you'll go look at all the social media stuff, and you're heartbroken, and you're in pain, and yet you're seeing them. Well, they seem to be fine out in the restaurant or out at the party, because yes, they're fine. They've been getting over you for months. But it's very jarring to see when you're missing somebody so much and in such pain, to see them in there going on with life. And so for all those reasons, going to the social media and pursuing all these theories and hypotheses about what really happened, they're just rabbit holes. They're just going to prolong the recovery. They're going to make everything hurt more. They're going to create questions that you can't really answer, and then you'll think, well, the only real person who can answer them are my ex. Let me go and text them 100 times. It's a recipe for disaster.
Right. Well, if I thought the relationship was going great, somebody really surprised me by saying, we're breaking up, I need to find some kind of reason. If it's not clear to me, you suggest I make something up that I can live with.
Well, because most of our tendency is to make something up that's actually going to hurt more. In other words, our natural tendency in that moment is to start reviewing all our deficits, all our shortcomings, all the things we're not enough of, you know, the things we have too little of and the things we have too much of, all our inadequacies, because somewhere there must be the answer of why we weren't sufficient for them. Now, the answer is typically much more mundane, much more boring. It's like, yeah, it was great, but they started to drift emotionally. The relationship was vulnerable. They didn't vocalize it. They slowly drifted away. They were falling out of love and not addressing it with you, so you didn't know. You know, I mean, these are not very dramatic explanations, but they're the most common ones. And if you're going to look for, you know, much more complicated and profound ones, you're going to be sorely disappointed. So rather than come up with something that explains it based on your inadequacies, why don't you come up with something that explains it based on theirs?
So in other words, he's got a problem with commitment. That'll make me feel like it wasn't my fault and maybe I feel confident in looking for a new relationship, that sort of thing.
Perhaps that, or perhaps, you know what, when you're in relationships, you need to be able to communicate to the other person how you're feeling and if something needs to be addressed. And they weren't good at communicating that. They were good at getting into relationships. They weren't good at working at being in relationships, or they weren't good at communicating to help a relationship get over a difficult patch, because most long-term relationships have had difficult patches, but two people have worked together to get over them, and this person's not able to cooperate or wasn't able to cooperate with me in that sense. So yeah, that kind of thing.
Why do we tend to idealize people and entire relationships after a breakup? In the relationship, we might have been able to acknowledge that the other person wasn't perfect or that we occasionally argued. But how come after it's over, all we can remember is how great things were?
Well, because our mind, and this is, I guess, the main premise of my book here, that is that our mind is working against us when we're heartbroken. Because unlike the hot stove, which we need to remember can burn us if we touch it, when it comes to the emotional pain we're feeling, our mind is responding the same as it does to a hot stove or any other kind of thing that would threaten us, poison, say, by trying to keep the memory as fresh as possible and keep the pain as sharp as possible so we don't make that mistake again. That's our mind trying to protect us. So our mind will evoke all these amazing images of our ex in their smile, these glossy, touched up, photoshopped, idealized versions of snapshots and moments and clips of everything that was wonderful about the relationship. And our mind does that so that we can hurt, so that we will remember, don't do that again. Except it's not a hot stove, it's love. We want to be able to find it again. So our purpose then is to equalize that, is to balance that out as much as we can. Now, we can't prevent our mind from issuing wonderful, images of bliss and romance and focusing on all the lovely moments and on the amazing smile. What we can do is, once that appears in our head, balance it out by adding the frown, adding all the bad moments, adding all the terrible weekends, and adding all the moments in which you were thinking, maybe I should break up with them because I'm really unhappy. And if you're having a hard time coming up with a list of your ex's shortcomings, there's an easy thing you can do. Just ask your friends. They'll happily give you a very long list of everything they didn't like about your ex, and you didn't either.
You actually suggest that people make one of these lists, and while they're trying to get over a breakup, keep that in their phone, and when they start to pine, just pull up the list of negative qualities.
Yeah, I say put it on your phone, laminate it, and put it on the fridge. Just remind yourself, because your mind is going to bombard you constantly. Mm-hmm. You're going to see that restaurant. Oh, we had such a great date in that restaurant. You might have. You probably had a screaming shout fight match in there as well. You're not going to remember that. And so that you really have to be judicious about balancing out the picture. And this is not to vilify the person. This is not to make them out to be more terrible than they are. Just more human, just more balanced, just to remind yourself it wasn't all roses, it wasn't all perfect. There were plenty of very difficult moments. They weren't perfect.
What do you say to people who worry that this was their last shot at a relationship?
I hear that all the time, and I'm never sure why it's somebody's last shot. If somebody's 99 and they're just getting broken and say, I might not find another relationship, I would probably say, there are plenty of other people in that home where you live, so who knows? You might meet them at lunch. But people really say that because it's an excuse they're giving themselves to not go out and look again. It's a risk-averse excuse to not set themselves up and not put themselves out there and risk more rejection or more heartbreak. And I completely understand why, when your heart is completely shattered, putting yourself out there and risking rejection or further disappointment and heartache is not high in the top of your priority list. But that's just a reflection of where you are in that process. It doesn't mean that that's where you're going to be in a week or a month.
My guest is psychologist and author Guy Winch. His new book is called How to Fix a Broken Heart. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is psychologist and author Guy Winch. His new book is called How to Fix a Broken Heart. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Besides getting over the other person and no longer wishing that they were part of our lives, Guy, one big change during a breakup is that we have to redefine our sense of self, right? We go from being part of a couple. Maybe we have automatic activities and a social life that goes along with that, to, you know, reasserting our identity as a single person. Why is that adjustment so hard?
Because it's really pervasive. It actually really encapsulates not just very real and many aspects of our very real life in small and large ways, but it also involves aspects of our self-definition, of our identity, of who we think we are. Now, if we've been in a relationship for 10 years and we entered one at, you know, 26, and now we're 36 when we're exiting it, we've probably changed quite a bit. And do I go back to who I was before, to what I did before, to the kind of life I led before, or do I need to reinvent it entirely? Do I, you know, changing pronouns even, you know, I used to say, oh, our vacation, or we do this, and now it's I. And I compromised on 101 different things, from the kind of toothpaste I used to when I have my dinner, to the clothes I wear, to, you know, really every aspect of a relationship is a compromise. And now all those things I were doing in order to find middle ground with that ex is no longer around. So where do I stand on that? What's my fashion sense these days? What interests me these days? What do I want to do these days? Who are the people I want to be around these days? That ex was handling all our social life details. I'm not used to doing that. I have to really change how I manage my life, my social life. So there's a very comprehensive and profound shift that takes place. And there are many aspects of the new me that we have to actually think about and define, rather than go on autopilot and just fall into whatever habits seem to present themselves. It needs to be a much more thoughtful process.
You said there is no reason to assume that all the we places, like the places that you and your significant other used to like to hang out, are now off limits. In fact, we should go back and make new memories.
Well, because look, I mean, if you've been with somebody for a long time, right, then, you know, I mean, I practice in New York City, which sounds like a big city, but, you know, the places people go out, it's not necessarily. And so the people I work with, when they're heartbroken, it could be that within a 5-block radius of where they live, they've pretty much been to every establishment
right.
with their ex. So what now? They're not going to go to any of those places again because of the reminders? And yeah, the reminders are going to be difficult, and especially at the beginning. But you need to go through a reclamation process. Like, you need to be able to create new associations and new ways of thinking about these places that don't involve the ex, that involve the new you. Maybe that's a place you take your first couple of dates, just to kind of reestablish that, you know, it's where I was with my ex, but with new people as well, you know. And so you have to give thought, because our natural tendency is to say, I'm not going there again. I'm not going to speak to this person again. I'm not reading that newspaper again, I don't like that TV show now anymore. And we really narrow our world, because our world was very much, you know, involved the other person. And it's really not necessary to narrow your world in any way, shape, or form.
Sometimes at the end of a relationship where we knew somebody really well, thought we did, I guess, before they broke up with us, it can seem like a lot of work to start dating again. How can folks know they're ready?
First of all, it is a lot of work. It's an emotionally difficult thing to start dating again. Our tendency is to wait too long, to feel like, okay, now I'm really, really ready. Well, if you're really, really ready, you probably waited a little too long, because you need to remind yourself, you need to get back in touch with who you are as a single person, as a sexual person, as a, you know, how you present yourself to dates, what you're about, and what, you know, the impression is that you want to leave with people. And you need some practice in that. The longer you've been in the relationship, the less practice you've had. You need to kind of break the ice and probably have quite a few bad dates before you get onto the good one. Now, don't force yourself. In other words, if you're going to force... I've had people who said, well, I tried dating, but I just burst into tears over the first date. And I'm like, well, that's probably a sign you're not ready then. Mm-hmm. But short of bursting into tears, if the thought of it makes you literally start weeping or literally makes you slightly nauseous, you're not ready. But if you're slightly curious, oh, here's somebody I see on... Yeah, I swiped right on this one, and this one looks kind of okay. Maybe they're interesting. Even if those are the thoughts you're having, maybe that's sufficient then to go and find out if they're interesting or not. Because we know that the sooner people can get back into dating, that tends to be associated with quicker and healthier recoveries from breakups.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Mary calling from Laramie, Wyoming. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, well, my question is of a little bit different nature, and that is with regard to a broken heart suffered as a result of rejection by adult children. And I don't know whether the doctor has addressed this in other publications or not, but I'm curious as to whether or not he has.
So I haven't written about that specifically in terms of writings, but I can tell you this. I mean, that is heartbreak. Being rejected by any family member is especially heartbreaking. But when it's your children, the people you brought into the world and raised or adopted and raised, then it's especially heartbreaking. And sometimes it happens, and sometimes it happens without a clear explanation about why the kids are breaking ties with you. It can be related to the people they're around or the people they're with. It can be related to many, many different things. It could be they've been telling you all along why they've done it, and you've had a hard time actually hearing what they've been saying. So it's a very individualized, it's very unfortunate, and I'm very sorry that this is happening to you, but it's a very individualized case-by-case thing. So without knowing more of the details, and I'm not sure this is the best place to get into them, but without knowing more of the details of what happened, how it happened, what's the evolution of that, it's hard to suggest what the person might do about it, because in some of these cases, there's things you could do, and in some, there's really, the door just isn't open.
How do you talk to people about being upset that they've wasted time, right? At the end of a relationship, no matter how long it's lasted, if it's over and everybody agrees it's over, sometimes people feel like they should have spent that time in a different relationship.
Well, I mean, yes, hindsight is always 20/20. Mm-hmm. But look, here's the thing. I would wager that there is something you can learn from any relationship of any length. There are some takeaways you can extract from that about yourself, about what to do differently going forward, about how to think or how to conduct yourself or how to communicate about certain issues going forward. We should be able to learn truly from anyone that we're dating or certainly any relationship that we're in. There should be some takeaways we can learn. And if we can extract those, if you can figure out, well, what did I learn from this? What did that experience teach me about myself, about other people, about how to handle things in a better way? And if there are those takeaways, then it wasn't wasted time.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-933-5372. We have Tim calling from Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hello there. I've got a lot to process right now. I've been in a relationship for 8 months, and I recently found out the reason why my girlfriend has been withdrawing from the relationship is because she had committed bank fraud, and she is now in federal prison. Hmm. While she was in federal prison, I also had found out that she was in a relationship for 3 years with another guy out of state.
I'm sorry that happened to you, Tim. Any thoughts, Guy, as far as how Tim can sort of recover from all this?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is one of those situations in which there's so many double whammies going on, like that maybe triple whammies, that, you know, you have the loss of the relationship to deal with. That's, you know, tricky enough. But now you have this understanding of maybe I need to reorganize my entire perception of who she was and my entire perception of what the relationship therefore was, and what therefore did that mean in light of this new information, and what did this mean in light of this new information. And so that's a very challenging task, and I suggest in these kinds of situations, it was 8 months. It was different if it was 8 years, because that would be even, you know, I think much harder. But it was 8 months, and, you know, it does take a while to get to know someone, and it does take a while for the masks to come down and for the shields to come down so you really get a sense of who they are, and sometimes we never quite do in 8 months. Even in relationships that are ongoing, and sometimes people say after 5 years, oh, now I'm finally getting to really get to know the person. But so my suggestion to you is, by all means, spend a little time doing some thinking about this and see if you can spot the red flags that you might have missed, see if you can figure out how you feel about it. But because it was 8 months, this is one of those that, we people who are deceptive like that are usually skilled, and we should not blame ourselves for being deceived. We should not blame ourselves for not seeing something that somebody can easily hide, and not getting something about a person that they can easily obscure from us. So just don't add self-blame to the situation. You have enough on your plate.
You note that there's something like a statute of limitations for the patience of other people in helping their friends deal with breakups. Is it reasonable or even helpful to suggest to somebody, like, it's time to get over this?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting thing, because our empathy for emotional pain does come with a statute of limitations. For physical pain, usually not. In other words, if somebody's a burn victim and they're getting bandages changed for a year and they're in pain for a year, every time those bandages are changed, no one's showing up at the hospital going, oh, stop complaining. You know, like, we have significant empathy for it. But there's this unconscious thing that happens in our head that we can care as much as we might about the person. There might be someone we really care about dearly. But when we think they should be over it, and they're not, our empathy dissolves rapidly and turns into feelings of annoyance, resentment even. And some of us will try to hide that, and then at some point it'll just come out like, oh, come on, I've heard that story 10 times. You know, in other words, and we'll start to lose that empathy because we feel, okay, they're not moving forward. They really kind of should be over it. Now, that's our extraordinarily subjective, unscientific assessment of when we, you know, somebody should be over something. But certainly people do get stuck, because part of the premise of my book is that we really don't know how to deal with heartbreak beyond, you know, time and social support. We don't really know what the do's and don't do's are. So we typically go through this for much longer than we need to. And some of us really get stuck, really, really get stuck. And if, you know, it's been 3 months and you're hearing that same story for the 10th time, I think it's okay to say to the person, look, I want to point out something to you. I really hate that you're still hurting, but you've said that 10 times already, if not more. And to me, that's a sign that you're not moving forward, that you're getting stuck on certain points. So maybe you need to get a little bit of help here. Maybe you need to approach this differently. Maybe you need to kind of change how you're thinking about it, because it sounds like it's in a loop rather than actually progressing in what your thinking is.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Let's go next on the phone to David in Austin. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a question for your guest. I was wondering, you know, when a person's going to leave somebody, they have a chance to contemplate that, and so when it happens, the other person is not so much in shock as you are. But I wonder if there's any, like, underlying signs where you can see it coming, because if there were obvious signs, you would obviously see them. So I was wondering if there's any way you could answer that question for me.
Thanks for your call.
Yes, so just to make sure I understand, the question is, are there signs you can note of that somebody, that the person you're with might be thinking of leaving?
I think that's the question, yeah.
Yeah, and look, this emotional drifting is the sign. The engagement is the sign. You can tell, and often, unfortunately, only in hindsight, but in hindsight, you look back and you go, yeah, you know, they just didn't seem as present. They just didn't seem as engaged. They just seemed like when they were asking me how I am or what I think, they were not really interested in the answer. They used to, spoon me at night, and now they don't. They used to greet me with a kiss, and now they don't. They used to text me, I love you, during the day, and they haven't for 2 months. When you look back, you can see they seemed more disengaged. And it's the disengagement that you need to address. And when you see the disengagement, and by the way, if somebody's disengaged for an hour, give them some space. But if, you know, there are real changes in how they are with you, the quality of the connection you feel from them, I think it's very important to bring that up regardless and say, I'm feeling that you've been a little distant this past week. Is there something going on? If there is, that's by all means talk about it. So it's really about the engagement the person is displaying to you and whether they seem emotionally present or emotionally more distant. Those are the best signs that something is going on. Now, that something might just be that person's getting depressed or preoccupied or what have you. But a lot of the time it can be something that does reflect an issue with the relationship.
I want to shift gears a little bit here to talk about pets. When a pet dies, it seems like there are certain people who completely understand what a body blow this can be, and there are people who think, what's the big deal? Just go out and get another cat.
Yeah, look, and as opposed to romantic heartbreak, it's easier to go out and get another cat, except most people are not going to do that the day after. Sometimes not even the week after. They need to recover a little bit because it feels very wrong to go out and get another cat, you know, the day after your cat dies, or dare I say, to clone the cat or the dog. Anyway,
a whole other show.
I'm not going to get into it. But the issue is that if you think about how we are with our pets, so, you know, dogs, just as an example, you know, most people consider their dogs family members. People are with their dogs many hours during the day. Their dogs often sleep in the bed at night, as do the cats. The dogs are by their side. The dogs love them unconditionally. The cat has been there to purr against you for the past 25 years of your life, or 20 years of your life, or 15 years of your life, and has been there through all the ups and downs as a constant presence. And you are caretaking that animal. And we know from lots of research that it makes us feel good about ourselves when we're caretaking, when we're taking care of another person or animal. And in that sense, all animals are therapy animals, even the ones that are not allowed on planes. And so the idea is that is a extraordinarily proximal being that shares your life often in a much more comprehensive manner than your parents might when you live outside the home, than your siblings might when you live away from them, and that your children might when you live away from them. And so that loss can be incredibly profound, because if you lose a parent as an adult and it's somebody you spoke to, you know, once a week and you saw them a couple of times a year, they weren't in your thoughts every single day. Your pet was. Your pet was a part of your daily life every single day, every single hour, practically. So that loss can be extraordinarily profound for people and impact them very severely.
My guest is psychologist and author Guy Winch. We're talking about his new book, How to Fix a Broken Heart. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or ask a question about breakups on Twitter. We are at KERATHINK.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you jumpstart your resolution to learn something new this year, offering more than 100 personal enrichment classes to help spark your creativity or investigate new ideas. Details and schedules at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with psychologist and author Guy Winch about his new book, How to Fix a Broken Heart. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Back for a minute to the question of a pet who has died. You think we should get toys and dishes and other physical reminders put away as quickly as possible? I guess it's not so different from stalking someone on social media. They're reminders of what we've lost. Is it okay to look quickly, to encourage someone who's lost a pet to look quickly for a replacement pet?
I think it is okay, because the thing is this, when you are heartbroken from romantic love, you're probably not going to be able to fall in love with someone else until you're significantly healed. But that's not the case with animals, because animal lovers, and those are the ones who are going to mourn the loss of their animal most, right, are going to find the new puppy or kitten or horse or whatever it is kind of irresistible. Animals have an amazing talent to work their way into our hearts. And so I trust the animal to be able to get you to fall for it rather quickly. And so it's going to elicit some kind of guilt, probably when it comes quickly. And it's going to elicit feelings of disloyalty to the pet that passed away. And what I say to that is, you probably gave that animal an amazing life. And you probably gave it a much better life than it could have, certainly in the wild or in another situation. And so you've done everything you can for the animal. You were devoted to the animal. You ran home to feed it from work, and you walked it in the snow. And you know, in other words, people really sacrifice a lot for their pets. And so you really need to work on the idea of there's nothing really to feel guilty about. And that if you want to get a new pet and you feel like you're willing to take that chance, even if it's quite soon after the last one died, I think you should go for it, because that new animal will really find a way to work itself into your heart.
Okay, back to the phones. This time we'll speak with Maya in Dallas. Hi, Maya.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is mostly about finding closure. I was in a relationship with a guy for 4 years, and then we decided to get married. His parents were against it, so we broke up. I tried to find closure by meeting him for one last time, but it ended in him promising me a lot of things which he couldn't keep up. So I just want to find out ways to deal with this and find closure if I can.
That's rough, Maya. Thanks for your call.
That is very rough, and it especially feels difficult when it was because, you know, his parents didn't approve, and he, rather than taking your side and saying, no, this is the woman I love, took theirs and said, well, then I guess it's not going to work. And certainly there are many cultures in which that is the norm, and the loyalty to the parents can supersede the loyalty to a girlfriend or a boyfriend or, a new spouse even. And it's unfortunate. Now, in terms of closure, I'm not sure what you mean when you say you need more closure, because you understand exactly what happened. You understand, why they did it. And you understand that even though they were promising you all kinds of things, the bottom line is they were unable to stand up to their parents. They were unable to assert their will and override the wish of their parents. And that was what caused the relationship to end. And even when they're promising you things, they were fine about promising you things. It's the parents they weren't dealing with well. And that was the weakness there, that they couldn't deal with their parents in a way that preserved the relationship. And so you understand exactly what happened. You know what it was about. To me, I think that is closure. Now, if you have more things to verbalize to the person, you can write them a letter. And when you do, by the way, when you do that kind of thing, write somebody a letter or an email, I always suggest write it, edit it, put it aside for a week, then read it again and decide if you want to send it. But you can always do that if you need closure. But in terms of understanding what happened, it seems pretty clear.
Maybe what she wants is just not to be in love anymore.
Oh, that's what we all want in that situation. And to me, that comes under the rubric of recovery rather than closure. Because we need to, if you're saying to yourself, I don't have closure, that's going to prolong your recovery and make it hurt more. If you say to yourself, I understand what happened, I'm not happy about it, I'm really angry about it, I would have expected him to stand up to his parents and protect me and stand up for me and for us, and I'm very furious that he didn't. But I learned something very important about him. I learned something very important about his priorities and his ability to stand up for what he cares about, and it's very disappointing, for sure. But I need to keep that into account, and I'm trying to get over him.
All right, let's speak next with Steve calling from Allen. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are y'all today?
Hi.
My wife has an aunt that her husband has Alzheimer's, and a couple of years ago he went into a facility because she just couldn't handle it anymore. He just physically couldn't stay up all the time to see what he was doing. But anyway, what's happening is that she can't move on or let it go. That sounds callous. She's having trouble going on with her life now that he's in the facility. I mean, she goes to see him regularly and she talks with him every day, or up until he didn't remember as much. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm getting off point. But the question is trying to get her to move on. We got her to go to a help group of, people that are suffering that fate. But they only meet like once every 6 weeks. So she's not getting any help and she's not moving on. She keeps complaining about the same things over and over again. My wife has gotten to where she doesn't even want to talk to her anymore because we don't know how to help her. And she just said outrageous things like, no one's ever loved their husband like I've loved mine. And these things that, she's just trapped herself in this rut.
Well, thanks for your call, Steve. I'm sorry for your family situation. Any thoughts there, Guy?
Yeah, it's really, really, really difficult, that situation, because when your spouse develops dementia or Alzheimer's, and, you know, that's like really the depleting of the personality, and in essence, you've lost them already. There they are physically. But in terms of who that person really is and their functioning and their, you know, you've kind of lost them already. But then there they are. So it's not as if you've buried them. It's not as if, you know, it would be terribly guilt-provoking to think of going on with your life in terms of dating, etc. But it sounds like this person, this aunt, is stuck not just in terms of she's not moving on and dating, she's not moving on. She's still making her life about taking care of her husband as if he were home. In other words, it sounds like there wasn't a change that happened to her when her husband went into a facility that should have freed her up, that should have allowed her to kind of refocus back on her own needs and her own life. And it sounds like she hasn't done that. And there's the stuckness. And there's also the frustration of the family members who are like, you just keep acting as if, you know, keep feeling and behaving as if, you know, we've seen all this for many, many years now and it's not changing. The circumstances have changed. And I think it's very difficult. I think you can try and point it out to the person that, you know, you see them not moving on, that this is a time they need to refocus on their life, not talking about dating, but just like, you know, you have another 20 years to live. What's that going to be about? What are your focuses? What are your passions? When you're caretaking for somebody in the home, it's difficult to do. They're no longer in the home. There has to be a shift to focusing back on you. That's the best you can say to the person.
It sounds like Steve and his wife care very deeply about this aunt. With all due respect to their efforts, if she doesn't want to move on, does she have to?
She doesn't have to, but then you can say it's difficult for us to hear the same complaint over and over and mm-hmm. over again when you're not doing anything about it to improve the situation, and you can. So I don't mean to be unsupportive, and I care about you tremendously. It's just very frustrating when there's someone you care about and they're not helping themselves enough. So I just want you to be aware that I'm feeling the frustration. I think that's a fair disclosure there.
All right, let's go and speak with Robert in San Antonio. Hi, Robert.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was widowed about 8 years ago, and I found that the biggest problem that most of my friends had was dealing with the fact that I was dating. And my kids, of course, they also had a hard time with that as well. So how would you suggest somebody deal with that situation?
Look, it's tricky. I mean, I usually hear this, that kids are having a hard time with, dad dating again after mom dies. Don't hear as often about friends having a hard time, unless they were really mutual friends. But mutual friends should want you to move on, should want you to enjoy your life, should want you to find love again if you can. And if you're getting resistance from them, I really think you should have a conversation with your friends saying, hey, I want to be able to be happy again, and I'm getting the vibe from you that you don't support this. Can we talk about it? I'm not sure why. Yes, I'm sure you've been, you know, I loved her very much, but she's been gone for 8 years. And I'm still alive, and I want to be able to have a decent life. And it's the same conversation with the kids, really. And with the kids, you know, if this is true, you can say to them, look, my position as a parent, again, if you can stand behind this, is to say, my position as a parent is I will support you. If you love someone, I will try and support that, even if it's not somebody I think is great for you. If you love them, if it's your choice, it's my duty to support you in your choices. Like, it might issue a warning, but from there on, I will. I'm asking the same from you. I know you really miss Mom. I know I really miss her, too. But I want to be able to move on. I want to be able to be happy. And I want your support in that. So I would actually just address it with them and hear, you know, really what their objections are, what their concerns are. Maybe there are things you haven't thought about or you haven't really responded to, but that should open some kind of pathway of communication that could be beneficial.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychologist and author Guy Winch. His new book is How to Fix a Broken Heart. Let's go back to the phones now. Chris is on the line in Houston. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good, thank you. So mine's not as personal, but my question is about heartbreak in terms of is it a psychosomatic response to a socially constructed idea of relationships? Or is there evolutionary basis in the mechanisms of heartbreak?
I don't think it's a psychosomatic response. You know, I mean, you can in some way define every response we get as psychosomatic because it impacts us both emotionally and physically to some degree. But heartbreak is a very real thing. There's even something called heartbreak syndrome, and that's where somebody from heartbreak, and there's most recently written up in the New England Journal of Medicine last year, a woman who lost her dog at age 61, I think she was, had this syndrome, and in the syndrome it really mimics a heart attack, and not just in terms of a racing heart, and you know, because you get that in panic attacks that people think they're getting a heart attack, but here you have extraordinarily elevated levels of hormones, 30 times the norm, and you know, other kinds of symptoms that actually mimic heart attack, but you don't have the actual coronary damage. And the recovery, obviously, is much easier. But it's a very significant thing. And that, you could say, well, that's a bit of a psychosomatic response to heartbreak. That's unusual. But heartbreak is not a construct. Love is not a construct. It's a very powerful, powerful feeling. I mentioned earlier in the hour this, information we have about love and addiction, that, you know, there are love scientists who want love classified as an addiction because it follows all the hallmarks and it triggers all the same responses. So that's a very real thing. And the withdrawal of love is a very real emotional injury that we sustain and one we have to overcome. So I don't think there's anything manufactured about it, really.
So we can all experience heartbreak. Just about everybody has. As a mental health professional, do you see patterns, or is there a way to predict who will really get stuck in heartbreak and who will move on, as painful as it is, in due time?
Look, you can sometimes, if you are a therapist and working with someone and you're familiar with their coping mechanisms, in general, you could surmise how those might operate in the event of heartbreak. But for most of us, even within ourselves, we might find that one breakup, we kind of were extraordinarily sad and weepy, but we managed and we got over it. And then the next breakup just completely shattered us and we were non-functional for weeks on end. Hmm. So it's difficult, even within the same person, to predict how one heartbreak will impact them versus another. It is so related to the feelings we had, the hopes, the expectations, the context of our lives. And that's such an individualized thing. So I think it's actually quite difficult to predict. I've seen people who are extraordinarily stoic, who faced life challenges that were unbelievable, and yet it's heartbreak that shattered them, or pet loss that shattered them. So I think it's actually a little tricky to predict how anyone will respond, even how we ourselves will.
What's your best advice for being a good friend to somebody dealing with heartbreak?
Patience, first, because like I said, it's probably going to take them longer to recover than you think it should. And active listening. You know, when people need emotional validation, if they, you know, cry their heart out to you for an hour and your best response at the end of it was like, wow, bummer. that's not going to be very fulfilling for them. It's great that you understand how they feel. You have to be able to articulate that in a way that they feel that you get it. And that's the key element of active listening. Make them feel you get it. And that can be non-verbally. It can be with oohs and ahs. It doesn't have to be even words, but it has to be this very attentive way of listening in which you go, yeah, I really understand that. Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. You know, that you say the things that they really feel understood. That is very powerful, and that can be very helpful to people.
Guy Winch is a psychologist in private practice and author of the new book, How to Fix a Broken Heart. Guy, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you very much for making time for us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Find the podcast pretty much anywhere you find podcasts. Whatever app you use, the Think podcast will be there and you can subscribe. You can learn about upcoming shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.